right. Well, welcome to yet another episode of, I don't know, man. It's supposed to be Fuck You Friday. Maybe it's FYF. I mean, this whole thing about commercialization and people are worried about coming on the show because we say the word fuck. Whatever. I don't want to go too far. But I'm your host, Wynn Silverman. This is my co-host, Casey LeBlanc. I'm super excited to have Jay Valentine from the Bay to be visiting with us today. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm really excited to dig into some things. But what we always do, Casey, and just do a truncated version of it, I want to let JV know why we're here. What kind of the basis and origin of this podcast is meant to be about. And then I want to jump into some things, if you don't mind.
Well, I think one of the easiest things is that we want to talk about the music industry and how it applies to some of the things we were talking about. We can't even figure out a name for this podcast because of some of the bullshit people not understanding, like, oh, this is not good for my brand.
Right.
How are people going to view it? And you said something right off camera that was like, well, the music industry isn't like that. So tell us a little bit about, first, who you are, what you do, and then how the music industry is kind of like the last living, kind of industry that doesn't really give a fuck. So you were like, yeah, I could go on Fuck You Friday. Like, talk about that a little bit.
My first thought was fuck it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but being kind of a lifer in the music business, like I was telling you guys off camera, it's the Wild West. Like, the music business is the Wild West. It's a place where, for the most part, anything goes, right? And you create your narrative. And what you are, there's no true governing body. Like, people bring up, like, oh, well, you know, you guys have the Grammys, and you guys, that's just a membership, literally. Like, you join the Grammys. You join if you want to. It's not like, oh, I had a hit record or I wrote a really good song and now I'm a Grammy member. No. The Grammys is the Soho House, and I'm sure you guys have been to the Soho House.
We're very familiar.
Yeah. You have to join the Soho House, and you have to pay a membership.
And nobody knows that. That's so funny, right?
Unless you're in the music business. Like, even with that, we watch, you know, the Grammys every year, and people complain about it. Why wasn't this nominated? Why wasn't this, that? Every song doesn't get nominated. It's not like some factory of people that are just sitting in the back going through every release. No, your song has to be submitted. It has to be voted on. You got to go be a politician. You got to show up to certain things. Like, it's a whole.
It's a bureaucracy, right?
Like, absolutely.
And so it's just like a lot of other industry where there's a lot of bureaucracy and you have to play the game. So let's talk about that. What is the game in the music industry?
What's a label?
I know nothing. So I want to know.
I own a label. What the fuck does that mean?
So before we get into that, because I went past. I am a Swiss Army knife in the music business, is what I would like to say. I've done a lot of different things. I started off in the creative space. My father, street guy who wanted us to be in music, he always wanted to be a musician and wanted to be in music and pushed us as his kids into music really early from the creative side, singing, dancing. I started on Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco as a street performer.
Stop, just real quick. So, from a parenting perspective, I just want to flip this just real quickly. You're saying you were pushed, but did you have instinctive love for wanting to be a musician or artist at a young age, or were you truly pushed?
I was pushed.
Okay.
No, absolutely. It was decided for
okay.
me. Like, my father's term was, you can quit, but you still have to practice. Fuck.
Sounds like you was a dad. But
I'm like, how does that work? No, sound like fucking Joe Jackson. Right. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he thought he was Joe Jackson, right?
Yeah. So, because they knew each other, right?
They did,
right? So that's for people that don't know you.
Later on, they did. Okay. Later on, they did. Joe Jackson actually.
Joe Jackson, Michael Jackson's father,
actually gave us our first deal. Our first deal when I was five. Literally a baby. My brothers were 10. They were twins. And I was 5. And we were, you know, and I had my oldest brother was 11, 12. He was 12. And we were signed to Jackson Records. And
were you guys a group or was
it? Yeah, we were a group. We were singing group. Okay. Singing and dancing and, you know, same kind of Jackson thing.
Right.
Right. Like, I guess I was somewhat Michael.
Yeah.
Not quite.
Hopefully, let's go with not quite.
Minus
a lot of things, hopefully.
No, fuck all that. Mike's a legend.
And if
I can find me a glitter glove, I'll put that shit on right now, right?
There's always a price.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
There's always a price, right? In success. Altogether, right? Like, at 5 years old, I'm watching Michael Jackson put on full makeup and mask to go to the rolling skating rink. Like, I literally saw that with my own eyes. At 5 years old, this man could not go outside. He was a prisoner of his own success.
How old was he about at the time?
He might have been 30. No, okay. Not even that.
So that was right at 20s. That was right at his peak.
Yeah, yeah. He was in
or his, just starting his peak.
He was in his 20s. No, he wasn't even in his 30s yet. No.
Yeah.
Like when I really go back on it, he might have been 25.
Okay.
This might have been like the around Thriller-ish. Like I think he had the first big album out. What was the one before Thriller? Off the Wall. Billie Jean was out. Like all that type of stuff. And literally seeing that was crazy to watch someone have to transform just to go outside.
Did you know Michael well enough to know what he was doing, like, behind the scenes to become Michael Jackson?
You mean as far as, like, the work ethic?
Success. Well, yeah, just some of the things that he was doing, because you knew his father, you knew the family a little bit.
We got glimpses.
Okay.
We got glimpses of just when he went into rehearsals and just really got... You know, got focused on that, you know, when they, I mean, but seeing these, and he was kind of the first artist that I got to see up close that had to go into those 12, 16-hour rehearsal days type of thing. Mm-hmm. That make you who you become, that make you great enough to stand on the front of the stage for 5 straight minutes and not say anything.
And you're just you.
And people lose their mind.
I have such a question because this is such a different side of the brain that I just haven't exercised and I have no talent, skill, or ability in.
I can attest to that.
No, so I'm very curious from the creative side. Like, how do people work hard? Like, I don't understand. Like, I understand in my world or in sports or when you say 16 hours, to me, when I hear a song, I don't know what goes into that song. I don't know what, like, the written part, the instrumental. Right. Like, for people that don't know or don't have the creative, can you walk us through what working hard means in the music industry?
In the music industry?
Yeah.
So, it starts with imagination. Like, trying to explain to people who don't do music what the process is kind of tough because it's sort of David Blaine. We're literally grabbing things out of the air and hoping that the world will love it. Whatever these crazy ideas are, whatever this crazy song is that you were driving in your car and now you're thinking of and you can't stop singing over and over and over and you're hoping that that this same song, when you go in the studio, it'll become what you hear in your head and then that other people can't get it out of their head, right? So it starts there. It starts with the imagination. It starts with experiences, right? For me personally, I felt like my inspiration came off of living, right? Like everything that I've ever experienced in life, I try to write about.
Through the music,
through the storytelling. But the hard work side of it is consistently doing it every single day, right? And so for me, the work ethic came from my father and him pushing at first of like, no, you're not going outside. We're rehearsing. And literally, we were rehearsing for drug dealers' birthday parties. Wow. Like, no bullshit.
Well, that's how you got paid. That's what musicians made money, right?
I mean, yeah. I remember, man, we would drive around San Francisco in the Bay Area and we would just end up at someone's house. And my father would be like, let's get it.
Damn.
And we start lining up and we perform for their kids. Like, there are still people.
And you're 11 at the time or
no,
five?
I'm like five.
Okay, your brother was 11. I'm okay.
Fucking baby.
God damn.
Right? Like, they used to wake me up. We would be in the cars because we would do like after hours places. Little kids, we would do after-hours spots.
Wow.
That were like, you know, y'all know what after-hours spots is and what's going on in after-hours.
Sure.
Especially in San Francisco.
We would come in and perform for the people at the after-hours place at 1 in the morning.
On a stage with how many people?
On a stage? No fucking stage.
Damn.
No.
When I say stage, I mean you just like a little curb.
Listen, y'all move out the way.
Wow.
That's what the stage
that is
would
put
be,
in your, right? I mean, that is. Yeah.
But it was
Wow.
It was the work being put in.
So you're seeing, too, at 5 years old, drinking, prostitution, drugs, the whole thing. No, so no, that's no, what, no. When you talk about gleaning experiences, like, you got a lot of 5 year olds are not seeing stuff like that.
A lot of 40 year olds ain't seeing that shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I saw things, ultimately, I wouldn't show my kids, mm-hmm. right? But this was the environment that I was in.
Right.
And it also prepared me for life, obviously. But this is just what it was, right? So, like I said, they would wake me up. I would be in the car asleep. Like, my father would be in there partying, and then he would come out, and he like, y'all ready? Wake Jay up. Wake me up. It's 1 a.m. on a Wednesday, Tuesday, school night, and I'm in there singing. Wow. And dancing around and learning how to keep the smile on while you perform and make eye contact and
entertain.
But it was, like you said, it's the hard work early. It was developing the skill of beating fear. Huh. Right? Like, what I see now with just artists, athletes, business people, fear is
crippling.
It's crippling. It's the biggest opponent.
Mm-hmm. Both. I mean, that comes from a long history of people not. Like, we've talked a lot about that in this podcast, like this idea of confidence and you learning it at a young age. But it's like exercising, right? You have to exercise it. You have to be around people that build you up. You have to understand that confidence is part momentum, right? And then it's not just going to be a linear line from left to right of good things happening in your life. It's rebounding and how you rebound and how you deal with adversity. Mm-hmm. So talk us through that, because that's an interesting component of it is – how you know, tell us about a time in your career, you know, given that that's the kind of the platform or basis of where your career started, of something like a moment in your career where you got punched in the face. And what did you do? What was the experience? And then how did you rebound from that?
So I'm 10 years old. My father's in the state penitentiary. Or no, I was 9 years old. My father's in the state penitentiary. He has to go do Fed time as well. So in his, I don't even know what you would call it, when they're
processing
him from state to federal, he escapes from prison. He escapes from prison and gets us a record deal. Wildest shit ever.
Wow.
Right? He gets us a record deal.
How long was he out for? Fucking 2 days and he's,
no,
he's brokering deals? Like, what the fuck? I want to know about that deal.
He took a couple trips.
Oh, back and forth. He got out a couple times?
No, I'm saying he took a couple trips to go make some money.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I got you.
Once he was out, he set us up in Los Angeles.
Wow.
Wow. And he gets us a deal. I have to tell the quick side of it because we're getting to, you know, the question you asked me of, you know, when did the punch in the face come? But I wanted to give a little context to, you know, how this thing all kind of transpired. So he gets us our record deal. During this whole time, he's a escape convict. Gets us our record deal. But this is 1990. There's no social media. Flying and traveling is different.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is different. You know what I mean? Shit, I think the ID might have been on a piece of paper back then. You know what I'm saying? It was just different.
Yeah, right.
So he gets us our record deal, but he's in a rush, right? Because he knows at some point they're coming back. So he's just rushing everything with our deal, but the label's loving us. They gave us a shitload of money, set us all up. And during this time, he's starting to put pressure on the record label. We were signed to MCA Records, which is part of Universal, that whole system. And he's putting this pressure on to make them do everything. We're going to put the video out. I'm going to make them go to radio. You got to put the album out. You got to do this. You got to. So everything is accelerated. Like within 6 months, we have an album out from being signed. And then back then, it's not like you can go viral.
Right.
It's not like, something is buzzing.
Right. You're stamping things.
Back then, you can't go viral. You can't buzz without a record label. So he's just, like I said, he's accelerating everything. we're being put out in the next 6 months. So, but it's like, it's, things are rushing. It's not going fast enough. And now he's having issues with the label. Long story short, somehow, FBI agents show up to MCA Records to come get my father when we're up there. I won't say who called them, but
yeah, we can glean.
They came to get him. And when he goes to jail, that wasn't the punch in the face. Because we're still signed. Our album is actually out at this time. So I was in a group called the Neutrons. It's my last name is New. My middle name is Valentine. And our name, the name of the group is the Neutrons. But if you look at the name, my father's name is Ron Newt. Neutron is Newt and Ron. We were literally named after him, sure, right? So sure. I can tell you what kind of guy he was, yeah, right? Like, yeah. Yeah. It's me.
Yeah, yeah. Don't forget about me.
I created y'all.
For sure.
Literally.
For sure. So he goes to prison. They work it out with the label to keep us on the label, keep us going. But my two brothers are twins. And I'm 11 at this point. It's about a year is going by from like 9 to 11, you know, in that middle where you turn 10, then you turn 11, whatever. And my brothers are like 16. During this time, my brother Ronnie gets mixed up in the streets in LA. And we had already come from that in San Francisco, obviously. You know what I mean? With our background, with my father's background, we had already, you know, we already come from the streets, and he just kind of gravitated back toward it with my father.
Creature of habit.
My father being in prison. So, you guys remember it was a movie called House Party?
Yeah.
So, there's a movie, House Party 2. Yeah. If you watch House Party 2, they actually have our album cover in the record store. It goes by our album cover. You see our album cover, the whole thing. But the crazier part is we were recording for the soundtrack. At the time, we're recording for the soundtrack at the time to perform at the Pajama Jammy Jam.
Oh, shit.
You watched the movie.
Yeah.
Tony, who yeah. I love those guys. They're sure. Bay Area guys as well.
Yeah.
They took our place in the movie.
Wow.
They took our place in the movie because while we were recording, during our recording process for the soundtrack, my brother got killed. He got killed robbing a liquor store. So he got back involved into pretty much the elements that we just came from when my father went to prison. Because now my father wasn't there anymore to kind of be the iron fist to make sure that, you know, we didn't get all the way out of pocket. You know what I mean? And like I said, when my father went to prison, my brother just kind of gravitated back toward those elements, those people, and just who he inherently was. Because I'm not a person that says, oh, well, they made him. Blah, blah, blah. He was, no. This is who, you know, he was as a person. And, you know, the other part that happened within the music business, this is just what happens. When things slow up in the music business, they cut off the money. Labels aren't just, like, they'll throw it out for a minute as things are going, but these budgets have to still be open. When my father went to prison, they cut our budget off. So now our life is changing.
Based on concern for the brand, as that, or
based on
return.
It's return.
No, yeah. It's business. Yeah. I don't care. You could tell me sports, music, anything.
Yeah.
If you put a dollar in, you want three out. That's it.
Right. And yes, we were kids and they were dealing with kids.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. It was still business.
Yeah.
Right? Like at this point, they're probably down 1.5 on us. You know what I'm saying? No return yet. So they cut the water off until they could figure it back out.
Right.
What does that do with us, though?
Because the 1.5's already gone?
1.5 gone. What? 1.5 gone.
1.5 in 1990.
Hey, listen. Hey,
you got to really try to get rid of that.
Listen, everything that these rappers are showing right now, I did that at 10. Yeah. Right? So
you know, like by most people's standards, you're like 140 years old.
Easy dog easy. Years.
Yeah.
Dog for sure. But that was the punch in the face. It was like on a Tuesday, because I remember the day he died. On a Tuesday, we're recording. with Spider-Man and Dr. Freeze, the producers who produced Poison for BBD, Jesus. The biggest song in the world in that day. We're recording with them Tuesday. On Wednesday, my brother gets killed. Ain't no bigger punch in the face than that.
No.
And then I have to watch it on, it was a show called Hard Copy. You guys remember that show?
Hard Copy.
Mm-mm.
So Hard Copy was like a show that pretty much they would tell you before they showed you the bullshit. Like, they were going to show you some, you shit might want to turn your TV off.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was one of those. But, and I had to watch my brother get killed on TV.
Wow.
And from being just on Soul Train 2 months before that, being on, you know, BET and all these different things, being on a tour around the country, performing around the country, to now my brother's gone, my father's in federal penitentiary, and we have nothing. Like, literally nothing. So we go from this 5-bedroom, 6-bathroom house, swimming pool in the back, to sharing my auntie's apartment in the projects in Fillmore.
So, and you're still 9 or 10 years old, right?
I'm 11 now.
11 now. I'm 11. Okay. So at 11,
you've lived a life.
You're being, but you're being asked to be 21. Nah, or 30.
I mean, I was paying taxes, shit. So I guess somebody had to pay the taxes.
You're an 11-year-old adult, right? So let's talk about. So that was the punch in the face. So then, what do you do? Like, what impact and what did you do about it to?
Resolve. How did you come to some sort of resolution emotionally?
I didn't figure it out immediately, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
My first thing was adapting to my new environment, which was my old environment before. But when I was in that environment before, I had my father, who was
the Rock.
Not only the Rock, but the King of the Jungle.
He was a legend.
You know what I'm saying? Like, my father is, you know, is cemented in the streets of San Francisco forever. You know what I mean? So I go back without that too. You know what I mean? I'm just thrown into whatever this shit got to offer me, which was just the streets and everything that came along with it. So I adapted by becoming a hustler. I adapted by becoming a hustler, and my first business was I started a bike business. I started a bike business because out of our record deal, I was the youngest, so I couldn't get a car. So I bought the most expensive bike I could find.
Mongoose.
At some whatever fucking bike store.
Yeah.
You know, I found some $1,500 dirt bike, whatever the fuck it was, to ride around with. And it was like the one thing I had left. From,
wow,
my hard work,
yeah,
as an entertainer and as a singer and having a record deal and all these things, because also the government took the rest of the money because my father was an escaped convict and his name was on the,
restitution, or?
Yeah, he took that,
yeah.
Wow. So whatever I made as a child, when I turned 18, they took already.
Wow.
So I didn't even have, and I, for a long time, I thought I had that waiting for me. So from like that 11, 12 to 18, I'm like, oh, yeah, it's probably some, you know what I mean? A couple dollars waiting for me. Shit.
Nope.
Not a dollar. So I start my business. I realize, so I've always been one of those people. I've never thought about reinventing the wheel. I didn't know what I was thinking at that time, at that age, but I always thought about making the car run smoother. Okay, so I'm watching my neighborhood, and I'm watching drug dealers, and I'm watching how they're getting around. I'm like, but they're, you know, they're confined to these few blocks that is their neighborhood, but they got to walk from here, they got to walk from there. So it's like, shit, okay. It's a big, you know, guy arrested dead. One of my guys, he passed. Huge, big time guy in my neighborhood back in the day. Saw me ride my bike, and it was like, I need your bike. I was like, for what? He's like, I need a bike. I need to get to it. What? But it wasn't, he wasn't going far enough that he needed to drive. But he was like, you know, he needed to ride his bike over here. Maybe he had a stash over there. Maybe he had some over there. So he's like, I need, little bro, can I get the bike? I was like, yeah, $5. Right? This is literally how it came. I was like, $5. He's like, all right.
Yeah.
He gave me $5. He rented my bike. So
this is good.
I need more bikes.
Right.
I need more $5.
Wait, so you were Uber back in 1992?
Yeah, sure.
What happened?
As Soulja Boy would say, I was first.
But they always say you don't want to be first, you want to be second. Because the first guy loses a lot. The second guy comes in like, hey, you got a good idea. But then my
business got illegal. Right. So the neighborhood I'm from, you guys are from the Bay Area.
What happened? You can't rent bikes?
Hey, I didn't have enough of them. So how do you get more bikes?
You steal bikes.
We got to steal the bikes.
You got to borrow them.
No, we were still listening. The statute of limitation is over on that shit.
Okay, all right.
We were stealing bikes like a motherfucker. if anybody's familiar with San Francisco, where I'm from is down the street or down the hill from the Full House. What would you call that?
The show?
The
Full House?
But the actual, you know.
The house.
The house.
Yeah, the actual house. Right.
Multi-million-dollar brownstones are literally walking distance to the projects. Most people that aren't from San Francisco have no idea about that. But you go up Grove and you get to the park and where, you know what I mean? It's right there where those houses are. I'm from Grove and Buchanan, which is right down the hill. So, got a couple of my buddies.
Good bikes.
And I'm like, listen, because I had to get my bike fixed one day. And I realized an older guy showed me that an Allen wrench, at that time, those bikes, I don't know about the bikes now, but an Allen wrench literally can do everything you need for a bike. That little ass piece that they sell at IKEA now for the furniture.
Yeah, the L wrench.
Yeah. Right? So I'm like, okay, I just need one of those. And I can just, we got to go get these bikes. What I realized is that people back then, I don't know what they do now, I don't steal bikes anymore, but they only locked up one tire. Right. They would only lock up one tire, of the bike. So we would unlock that tire and run down the hill with the rest of the bike.
So technically you didn't steal the whole bike.
I only stole a piece, dog. I think you missed your calling, Mr. Defense Attorney.
I know. They don't pay well enough.
And then we had this little patio in the projects. And I just had 30 bikes on.
Wow.
And I would be taking pieces from one bike, putting them to this. If one of my friends stole a bike and they brought it to me.
That was a dollar.
No, I would give them, because I was renting the bikes and then I started selling them. Because I ended up selling mine, the master bike, because I needed more money. So I sold it for like $350. I got like $350 from the same guy who rented the one. He liked the bike. I ended up selling it to him.
An original.
And I would pay the guys $50 for every bike they brought me, and I would sell it for $150. Because I would have to do the labor, because they would bring me a piece of a bike. You know what I'm saying? But I need it. I'm like, okay, I got a tire from here. I got this from there. I'm literally on the patio, like, fixing. My mother would be like, I'm like, these are all my friends' bikes. Like, they just need their bikes fixed. Right. Like, they pay me a couple dollars. I'm fixing bikes.
Right.
I had a full bike ring. I don't know if that's a thing. Is that a thing?
It is now.
A bike ring.
I believe that's being of a new show. Bike ring.
But I was renting bikes $5 a day, and I was selling bikes for $150. And if you rented my bike, I would walk around my neighborhood and I would look for you. I would lit, and I'm like this tall, but I would be walking around there like the Tasmanian devil. Like, you seen such and such? Like, no, I said, he got my bike, so tell him.
Come see me.
But I'm talking about, like, big-time drug dealers. Yeah, like, big time enough to me. I'm 12. They're 19.
Right.
We're talking about a 12-year-old here. We're talking about a 12-year-old.
Yeah. Right. And I would be looking for my bikes, man. Yeah. And that was my first business. So that's how I adapted.
Survival.
Full.
So walk us through then. Jump ahead a little bit for us to get us into the music industry and how. So you went from performer artist to to entrepreneur. I call that entrepreneur. Yeah. So walk us through then the start of your career, and then tell us a little bit about like some of the things you've done, like songs you've written, things that you've done in L.A. to give us some context.
You've literally danced around art from a musician's perspective, entertaining, from management. I mean, you've touched all these different aspects of art, and now you're drawn, and we'll come full circle at the end, but yeah.
Like, tell us what you, give us some of the things on your resume from an artist perspective and things that you've done in the music industry to get there.
So before I'm still in San Francisco, I'm in San Francisco from like 12 to 18. But I'm back and forth. I went to LA for a little bit. My father got out of prison, but I became a basketball player. I really liked basketball, and it was kind of like my saving grace. It had got me away from even, you know, the bike thing, from the whatever else thing that I was involved in. And it gave me something to do and something to focus on. Because when I didn't have music anymore, it was like I didn't have any of that type of focus to where it was keeping me away from trouble, right? Because now I'm like, you know, I'm in stolen cars with guys and I'm drugs and this and like I said, the bikes.
And whatever else, and if whatever, you didn't find basketball.
And whatever else comes with that. But I found basketball because my brother, my older brother, who was also in the group with me, loved basketball. So I followed suit. He's the reason why I followed into music as well. He's the one who really kicked everything off, my brother Bobby, who you play with him, and my nephew is his son. So that's what really kicked everything off for me. It started with him, me following him into music, and then me following him into basketball. And then the basketball taught me how to deal with people and taught me how to, in a sense, manage. I wasn't super tall, so of course I played point guard. So now I knew I had to learn how to manage the guy who wants to shoot all the time, the guy who I can only get him to play defense if I find him on the break, the guy who is our best player but has the worst confidence. So the guy I got to go put my arm around him, be like, man, they can't stop you. Come on, dog, I got you. You know what I mean? Like, it taught me my early management skills.
Right.
Sports is a model. I mean, this comes up a lot. Sports is such a fascinating model for business and life. I mean, what you're articulating right now is what we so deeply believe in, that sports not only opens doors, but it's a perfect model to learn how to succeed. And you're putting it in the context of managing personality. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny. Did you know that at the time? So when you're 18 years old, you're a point.
Hell no.
Yeah, because a lot of times you don't, right? No. Like there's these natural things. I want to ask you the same question that I asked Coach in our last conversation was leadership. Born, learned, both.
Leadership?
Mm-hmm. Like just the idea that you just said, which is leadership.
Leadership is born.
Can it be learned?
No.
Really?
No.
Can't.
To be a leader. No.
Really?
Because there also takes certain
characteristics.
Certain characteristics. And to be a leader, you also have to be a risk taker. You can't learn to take risks.
You don't think so, huh?
No, man. Like there's you watch kids, right? And there's certain kids.
I try not to. Cool. Keep me away.
Cool. Cut.
Those things are dangerous and expensive.
Financial disasters. I'm sorry. I told you I was going to at one point have to apologize for things.
No, that's amazing.
I apologize.
I just realized I'm the only man up here with no kids. With kids.
I may have a few in Sweden, but I'm not sure. Rachel, I'm sorry. I don't know.
Hilarious. Yeah. But the point I was making with that was that you watch the kid that you take to the beach and the one that wants to run into the ocean. You can't teach that,
you know,
because you can tell a kid, like, go run out there. And they're like, I'm not, I'm going to drown.
So you throw them out there, right?
You know what's interesting? And
parenting 101.
So we have conflict. We're friends.
Listening to your parents.
We're friends, but we're not. Sometimes we have conflicts. I majored in religion. He majored in actually making things happen. And I want to take this biblically because there's an interesting I think it's Old Testament. There's this story about, I know this is, you're going to be interested in this, but you know, you're hitting on something that's spoken about biblically. And it was, someone was trying to train and pick the soldiers to fight against, I believe it was the Amalekites, if my memory serves me right. But so they went through a trial. It was just like a basketball trial. They saw I could shoot, saw I could pass, saw I could dribble. And the story goes that the way the soldiers were selected is they said, okay, take a break. And the way they picked the soldiers is there were people that took the water from their hand and drank the water. And then there were the men who went right into the water and drank like a beast.
Right.
And that's how, I think it was King Solomon perhaps, he chose his army. So it's what you're speaking to in a way. There's traits.
I believe so. You know, I don't know if I'm right or wrong in that.
No, you're wrong. But I was just we don't always have to agree, right? The reason that I ask is not so I can have somebody tell me what I already believe, I love listening to what everyone believes, and I can always change my opinion, but I think asking enough people what leadership skills that they have, how they developed them, how they exercise them, I think is important. And a lot of times, I do believe that there's some inherent traits of leadership that come from an early age. I think parents identify it and exercise it at a young age and encourage it at a young age. But I think sometimes it fizzles, right? And I don't think that leadership in different stages of your life is necessarily born with. Like if the 50-year-old can learn and create leadership skills and qualities down the road. So it's a fascinating topic, right? There's not a lot of actual hard evidence one way or the other. It's more of a belief and an experience level that's why I'm always curious to find out what people think.
Yeah. So from that point on, you know, I went through my stage of, I guess, learning what I was ultimately going to be. I had no idea. And I'm getting through high school. I get through high school. I'm a basketball player at this point in my mind. And I keep having things that bring me back to music. Obviously when my father got out of prison, he was just like, listen, you sing.
You're going back.
But at this point, I'm 13 turning 14. I feel like I'm, you know, at least a young man. And I got my own thoughts and what I want to be and what I think this is going to be. And, we're back and forth on it. It's a little combative. But I'm realizing, though, without saying it, how much I still love music. Right? Like, it's still something that's pulling at me that I want to be a part of. And so ultimately, you know, the time goes by. I get out of high school. And I'm making my decisions on life. Because my parents let me make a lot of decisions for myself. Outside of my father really wanted me to do music and being, you know, heavy on that. But for the most part, maybe they identified that in me. Like you said, right? They identified that, okay, he makes sound decisions, even for a young guy. Because
they're the point guard of your life.
Right.
Right? They got to say, hey, this kid can do this well. He can't do this well. We need to accentuate that. We need to exercise that.
They let me rock, though. They really did let me rock.
But that's the leadership part of it as a parent. That they have to pull it from you, is what I think.
Of course.
Or I'm just going to keep going back to that. I'm convincing you in the next 20 minutes.
Nah, you're not. No. I was born like this, dog.
Great response.
So I had $150.
Because you sold a bike?
Sold some other shit. And then I had, you know, then I had to spend some shit. I had to buy shoes. And, you know what I mean? I always had to buy shoes.
That's fair, same.
So I had $150. I had $150 and an opportunity to fly to L.A. A guy that I had met during my teenage years doing the back and forth music thing with my father when he first got out was like, yo, you know, come out here and, you know, I'll introduce you to some people. You know, I want to hear the stuff you're working on. Like, I literally cold called him. So I'm like, yo, like, what's going on out there in L.A.? Because I didn't want to be a starving student. I didn't want to be a starving student, and I didn't want to be a drug dealer. And to me, staying in the Bay Area, those were my two options. Mm-hmm. I could be a starving student at a school, or I could sell drugs. Those are my options, in my mind.
Motivated then a little bit by fear?
No.
Motivated by what?
Motivated by, I need to get to some money.
But the fear of being poor.
Yes. The fear of being poor, yes. The fear of being poor. But not even the fear of being poor, because I had been poor, so I knew what it felt like, and I knew I could handle that. Because
you could get money doing the other two things.
But I just wanted it. Right. Okay. And I wanted it now. I didn't want to live under anybody's roof. Like, I was that kid. Like, somebody telling me what time I got to come to the house. I'm about to be 18.
And your 18 is a little different than most people's 18. Yeah, I mean, just based on what I'm hearing.
You're about 47 by 18.
Like, straight up, like, that is a different, you've lived a different life, right? Your father, if he's a legend within San Francisco, you see that. You see how he interacts with people. You see how
it's implicit.
You see how he gets people to do things for him. Like, you see that at a young age. Yeah. That's a PhD in life skill, right?
And to some degree, it's alluring, right? Yeah. It is alluring, right? Because there's a level of CEO status in the streets.
Right.
You know what I mean?
There's like no doubt.
The guy that walks in as the big businessman is the same guy that walks in as the big dope boy or the big, you know what I mean? Yeah. Whatever.
Sometimes it's like, different too, because the dope boy has people that do other things for him that protect him, and the CEO
it's
just kinda,
so much.
The street is a little bit different. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is business.
It is business.
But it is business.
It does come down to dollars and cents.
So I take the chance on myself. I jump out there. I get out there. I have 10 songs. I've written 10 songs. That I had with me.
Were you writing all throughout your life?
I started writing at 15.
Okay.
My brother, once again, was like, yo, you should try it. My brother just was like, yo, you should, because he was writing. My brother wrote most of our album at when we were kids.
Okay.
When he was 10.
Okay. Wow.
Like, he just had it.
Wow.
And his daughter now has it. Like, she's, I think, 9 or 10, and she's already writing songs. Like, it's just something that passed on for them.
Hmm.
Neither one of my kids are involved in music yet. They don't.
Boycott.
You know, yeah, my boy won't play basketball.
Yeah, he can hoop.
And my daughter loves soccer, so they're more on the athletic side. But once again, me following my brother Bob and him telling me that he thought I should try it. So from 15, I started writing songs. All terrible. Horrible songs. Like, the first song I wrote about comparing some girl to ice cream or whatever.
Sounds familiar.
If I find it somewhere, shit, I might be able to flip it. Hey, it might be a TikTok.
You know
what?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Hey, that sounds great. That's a fucking hit.
Do we get to own that because we created that together?
No.
Okay.
No,
okay. Oh,
no,
sorry.
No,
all right.
No,
don't worry. Win wouldn't do anything with it. Anyway.
Nobody owns my publishing.
I got you.
Nobody. I own my publishing.
You learned that,
right? So I get out there. I got these songs, and it's my first time I realize what the competition in music is. Takes me to some studios, and I'm just listening. I don't play any of my songs. I'm listening to these guys, and I'm like, fuck. I'm terrible, right?
I got to get better.
This is my first thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'm fucking terrible. Like, my songs don't add up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to, like, critique everything. I'm like, my background sound fucked up. I don't know if I told the story good. Like, I'm really going through my mind, right? But I'm like, I'm cooler than him. I sing better than, you know what I mean? I'm finding my shit too, right? But I'm like, but I ain't on the level. I knew it though. I'm like, I'm not on the level. I got work to do.
That's a level of self-awareness that at that age is super rare.
Bro, I thank God for that.
100%,
because
there's people that never find that self-awareness.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. They think the ice cream song in 1990.
I meet them every day.
Yeah. I bet.
Yeah.
I want to hold this thought because there's two levels that we've talked about, right? It's this level of awareness that you want, but also this level of I believe in myself so much. That, like, we go back and forth on, like, the mentality.
Kanye West.
Right.
Kanye West.
It's a great documentary on, like, mindset and stuff like that and how he looks at the world and thinks.
Kanye West. So
talk to me about it. Like,
so
for you personally and then also in your industry, it's got to be fascinating.
So for me personally, like I said, I had the self-awareness of I wasn't there yet. But it didn't make me say I can't do it. It made me say I got work to do. I got to get better. I got to work on my craft more. More so than saying I'm just here, and they got to take it how it sound, and I just believe in it so crazy.
No. It's the thing is when people do that, it's them, right? You looked at it and said, I got to get better. It's my shit isn't good enough, and this what everyone does is, well, that producer's problem. Well, that label's problem.
You're saying
that coach's problem. We just had this conversation. It's like this inherent, like, ability to just take ownership, get better, want to get better, instead of blaming the world, blaming circumstances that or people around you that are just never going to change.
Yeah. I always felt like if I blame the world, I'm fucked.
You're fucked. You are fucked.
Because so much was thrown at me at such a young age that I'm like, oh, I could have folded 100 times over. because there was always something. So I could have used the excuse. My father went to the prison. My brother got killed. My this got that. I live in the projects now. Or this and like, and I just looked at it like, I got to figure this shit out. I don't want the things that I have and the things that are going on. I started to realize why they were happening. Right? I'm like, okay, well, my father went to prison because he's doing illegal shit. My brother got killed because he was robbing a liquor store. Happened on accident. Yeah, like,
spontaneously. No,
these are events that happened because of decisions that were made. Mm-hmm. So it really early on, I started to think about my decisions. And one of my decisions was, I got to work harder because this isn't good enough yet. Right? It all just started to come back around. So I didn't play any of the songs for anybody. I tucked them. I was like, nobody's going to ever hear these fucking 10 songs because they're not good enough. And a friend of mine at the time was a bubbling producer. He was getting, and I had met him a couple years before. He just found out that I was in L.A. because I had moved around a couple of studios. He literally found out I was in L.A., called the house that I was at, the first guy that let me sleep on his couch.
Just think about that for a moment, having to call the house versus.
Yeah. Right. It wasn't no cell phone.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they had them, but I didn't have them.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So he called the house and he's like, yo, I'm going to come pick you up. I was like, yo. The guy turned out to be Damon Thomas, Kim Kardashian's first husband. And I hate to say it like that, but I say it because he just did a podcast. He did Vlad TV. Where he mentioned me, actually. Yeah. And so, but I, like I said, I hate to say it like that because he's so much more accomplished than that.
Sure.
But that's what he's known for.
Right.
Right. In the media sense. Mm-hmm. But he's a Grammy Award winning and all these amazing things. But he was the guy who called and was like, listen, like, come by the studio, come work with me. And it went from there, and I just start writing songs every single day.
So what's the most famous song you've written?
The most famous song or the most famous project is two different things.
Both.
So yeah. The most famous project is probably NSYNC. They sold 13 million records.
I've heard of them.
Yeah. From this one album. I wrote Celebrity, which was the title song to the last NSYNC album.
Okay.
Ever. Like, they're never making another album.
I thought they were touring again, no?
Nah. I just had this conversation with Justin about 2 months ago. I was like, listen, man, the culture is
no, way, not in know. Sync. What's the other boy band?
Oh, New Kids on the Block.
Are they touring again?
New Kids on the Block. Because
they ran out of money or something?
Nah, man.
No. They just like money.
That was my first concert as a kid. Yeah. I grew up on New Kids on the Block, yeah.
So there's
not because thing. I was, not because I mean, I had a sister.
Hey, man, listen, bro. You can like New Kids on the Block.
It's okay.
Not, it's still not comfortable.
No, bro. Like, New Kids on the Block was the shit, dog.
Yeah, you're good.
Am I turning red right now?
Yeah, it's okay. You're good.
Yeah.
It's a safe place.
But see, in here, and I'll kind of go to another thing with that, because you spoke about the money with that, right? Because that's the first thing people think with music, that eventually it just runs out. It can. But there's one thing that music has that nothing else has. Is there's always somewhere you can perform forever. So New Kids on the Block can perform Please Don't Go Girl until they don't want to for the rest of their life, and somebody will pay them to sing that forever. And that's the one thing that sports doesn't have.
Right.
There's no, you can't resell that house that you sold already 10 times over. The NFT is creating something that, you know what I mean?
Talk about that later.
Right? But in music, if you've had at least one hit record, a hit record, like a record that people want to hear, somebody wants to hear it somewhere around the world.
So let me ask you a question, just again, from the business perspective of music, because when we were kind of growing up, we're similar in age, but when we were growing up, what was that app? Napster?
Napster.
Yeah. That was a big deal in the music industry, right?
Yeah, no, it changed the game.
Right? Mm-hmm. And now there's all of these platforms and they're pay for, and so there's a lot, it's a lot easier to get distribution, right? If you can get it. But there's a lot more there's a lot more talent or people that think they can do it. So from your perspective,
I would take the other side.
But yeah. That's what I'm saying.
People that think they can do it.
Exactly. So that's
not a lot more talent.
It's a question mark. I don't know enough about your industry and your space, but I want you to talk about it a little bit, about what happened at that moment in the music industry, and what did it do to people saying, you know what, I've got Spotify, I can post my shit, I can do whatever I want.
So,
like, where are we at right now over the last 20 years?
Subscription-based now.
Right?
Right? Like, everything is a subscription.
But, and like, if I put a song, pieces. I could put a song on Spotify, right?
But you're not getting paid as the artist. Well, very well.
No, but you're getting paid. You're getting paid, but it's not a lot, right? Because there's so much of it. There's so much music, and there's, like, a thousands of a penny for every stream type of
thing. Is that what it is?
Right? Okay. It's something.
And is that because the label is what owns the master, which is what licenses out? How does that, who wins if there is
the streaming money? Company.
The streaming company
wins. The streaming company wins.
So how do labels, like, walk us through the business side of music.
So pretty much the labels went and cut a deal with these streaming companies. And in that deal, you know, they licensed the records to them so that they would be able to make money together. You know, it's really, you know, and they did what they always do. They did some backdoor shit, and, you know, they had enough ownership and enough market share to, you know, get what they needed. And then their deals with the artists are what their deals with the artists are. So whatever, it's like, okay, now if you're getting, let's just say, for every dollar they're getting, the artist is getting 15 cents, maybe, right? Depending on how your deal is structured.
Mm-hmm.
You may have a profit split. You may have a label deal, right? You may share in the licensing agreement. You may share in the master. You may own the master. It can go so many different ways. Nothing is a blanket deal in the music business.
Okay.
Right? It just depends on how you come to the table. Now, if you come to the table with no accolades or no buzz or no
leverage,
there's no leverage, there's no pipeline, there's no money for them to know, like you said, if I put a dollar, I'm getting three back, it's going to be more advantageous for the company. It's just business, right? And I think what happens with music is creatives, like, we get in a space of, it's our baby. I wrote that song. I wrote that about a girl who broke my heart. Or I wrote that about some situation.
Truly soulful.
I wrote this about my mother. Well, that song you wrote about your mother helped pay for your groceries. And when you needed to buy groceries, you might have undersold it because you were hungry. Right? And that's the business side. And that's the ugly side people look at. But nobody, like, my first publishing deal was terrible. Fucking horrible. But it made it so that I didn't have to become a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
So it saved me 5 to 10.
So tell me, what are you doing right now? Like, what are the things that you're working on in LA? Tell me about what life looks like for you right now.
So now I've gravitated over the last probably 10 years to more of the business side.
Okay.
I've been, you know, an executive in the music business full time the last 10, 12 years.
So are you now identifying talent?
Yeah, but I was always identifying talent.
Okay.
Right? I was always helping people get deals. I was putting people in place to do certain things, but I was doing it just kind of on some, for the love, because I was still doing my creative side and I was making my money that way. And I was writing songs for people, and, you know, probably my biggest song from an R&B sense is probably Tank's When We was a multi-platinum record.
Can you riff right now?
Not for free.
Not for free?
Yeah, I'm not one of those.
And listen, here's what I'll do. Here's what I'll do. From the business side, I'm willing to give you 0.00001% of however many downloads we get from this. But what I was going to say was, you didn't let me finish before. I already had to go in and negotiate it. But what I was saying was, can you riff about Wynn's basketball game?
I didn't come to talk about basketball.
That's just a subtle thing.
So listen, it's a very exclusive.
No, it's fair.
We don't talk about it.
Yeah, but there is.
Is it Fight Club?
There's some elite. Just know there's some elite shit that you're not invited to. How about that?
I create my own doors.
They told me you play football, man. They said, like, you would definitely be invited.
Yeah.
Okay. And since I'm the commissioner.
Actually, you know what? I think he was invited. I think you were invited, but you said, you know what?
I'm always invited, pal. You wait. What am I going to do? Wait for an invite? Get out of here. That's not how I got to where I'm at in life.
No, it's funny because that's literally what we say about the room. We're like, it's invite only.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then nobody gets invited. They just show up.
I've definitely had to
talk about management skills.
Yeah, I've had to, like, but that's the basketball shit.
It's the commissioner.
But yeah, from the music standpoint, bro, like the deals are they're structured very different. It doesn't, you know, and like when people say, oh, this is industry standard, they're fucking you. You know what I'm saying?
Best practices.
Like, because it's what you think you're worth or what you think it's worth. Mm-hmm. And you have to stand on that. Is what I believe, right?
So those actually translate to any business, mm-hmm. right? Those are just business fundamentals that I think can apply to a lot of different people. And again, if you're a W-2 job and you're negotiating with your boss, I always say, like right now, people should negotiate. Right? It's so competitive out there. People are leaving 30% of their dollars on the table.
I be throwing out some crazy-ass numbers, mm-hmm. and sometimes I get them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? And it's funny because, you know, Tank's my business partner, R&B singer, and businessman as well. And sometimes me and him would just get on the phone and laugh. He'd be like, what'd you ask for? I'm like, yeah. He's like, what'd they say? I said, they said, yeah.
It's crazy.
And that's just what this shit is. Okay, shoes, right? We all know where these shoes get made. We all know how much it costs to make them. We're out here paying aftermarket prices. Not the 150, but the 280, the 300, the 450, because it's just something we wanted. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want it, don't get it.
Right.
And this is the conversation that I have with promoters, with labels, with different people in the music business every single day. They're like, oh, you know, we think. Well, that's not enough. Well, y'all crazy. You gonna tell me what our talents are worth? No.
You got any tips then on negotiating? I think anybody no matter what industry, no matter what you're doing in your life, want to know some different tips and tricks on negotiating.
Do some research. Do the numbers. You should know the actual numbers, right? Like, let's say we're talking touring. We're talking hard tickets, right? If you're a guy who can sell out a venue I like to do round numbers. If you're a guy who can sell out a venue that capacity is 1,000. You sold 1,000 hard tickets yourself.
Eight.
You should look at what the ticket price is. You know, what the giveaways are. Literally do your homework. Figure out how much this shit is going to net. And then you should ask for more than that. And see if they go for it. And if they don't, y'all find y'all way somewhere around there. But in that, like, let's say a guy who can sell out 1,000 tickets. Should be getting $50,000 a night. VIPs, meet and greets. You know what I'm saying? Like
food and beverage.
Beverage that the artist doesn't touch. Get, right. We don't touch any of that shit.
Right.
You're gonna want a piece of the merch money. You're gonna, you know what I mean? It's your building. You're doing less promoting because of my social media. My artist has 2 million followers. He getting to more people than you getting to. So we're doing marketing for you now. Most people won't even book artists who don't have a big enough social standing now.
Right.
Because they're not going to and buying as many radio ads in those buys and TV spots anymore. Now they're saying, oh, well, can you do this drop for us? Can you make him post it on his page on this day?
Yeah.
I'm marketing for you now.
At this time on Tuesday?
So you figure out how to get the rest of that money. But for that 1,000-seater, I'm going to probably need 50.
Right.
2,000, I'm going to need that 100. And we're going to start you know what I'm saying? So when you see a guy doing Staples Center, I need that $500,000, $2 million, $1 million, whatever. We're going to find wherever that ticket price is.
Sure.
And that's where we're going. And that's what I want tonight.
Makes sense. And I like that, preparing, understanding your numbers. That's, again,
it's business. That's business 101.
All right, so before we wrap, right, let's just ask you a couple fun questions about it.
Okay.
All right, let's just start. So tell us something, a dirty secret about LA or the music industry that nobody knows. It doesn't have, You don't have to name names.
That nobody knows?
Well, at least like common people like Wayne. See, I like to put you on the spot a little bit. Let's just talk about some of the uncommon questions. Shit. Just a little L.A. secret, industry secret.
I mean, just not even a L.A. secret. Music industry secret.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if it's a secret because I don't think they people purposely hide it. That your lawyer is best friends with their lawyer. Hmm. And just take that however you want to take it.
Does that not sound like Louis Ziskin?
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
take that however you want to take it.
Yeah.
I don't care how much you think. They either went to some university together.
Yeah.
They worked at some label together. Yeah. This is just, and now they're handling everybody's business.
Who's a person in the music industry that you respect the most? And why?
Because this person is one of my best friends, and he's actually younger than me. Larry Jackson. He's the head of Apple Music. He's been my friend since we were, we're both from San Francisco. Came up in this game pretty much together. But I respect the path he's taken to get to where he's at, because he's been in the service industry the entire time. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, for me, I've been on the creative side too. So I know how it is to just be like, I ain't doing that. I don't feel like it. I just got to show up to this when I want to. But actually grinding purely from the service side is really, really tough. And I've watched him go from radio. He was radio disc jockey at KMEL.
Yeah. 106.1.
You know what I'm saying? To being, the head of A&R at J Records and at Interscope Records, and then literally being one of the first guys to truly merge music and tech with the Beats by Dre deal. He was a part of that with Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre. And then helping Timberland and Swiss Beats build up Verses. And just the things that he's been a part of, but then watching him also go make records with Whitney Houston. Like, I respect the shit out of the things that he's done.
That's pretty dynamic.
He's a guy who, I tap in with a lot. And he taps in with me, which is, it's my guy.
Right.
But I just respect the path, and I respect him just sticking in there.
Last question before we wrap. You had a really unique experience as a child,
mm-hmm.
both from the entertaining side of it, but also from the parenting side. You're a parent now. Wrap up with this of how you're taking that entire life experience, including your childhood, you as a son, you as a brother, and now you as a parent. How are you parenting your kids with that background? What are important things to you, and what are some things that you want to instill in your children, and how are you doing that?
Reality. I stand on reality. I don't sugarcoat. I talk to my kids as humans. I don't talk to them as children. Like, we have our moments, right? I'm a loving father, obviously, for me, but we talk very candid about life and about preparing them for what's coming and how they'll, and we never know how they're going to deal with it.
Nothing's linear.
But I give them as much reality as possible. I tell my son all the time, you like our life, right? This ain't your life at some point. You have to create your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, yes, there will be things for you that will be handed down to you, but to maintain the lifestyle that you're accustomed to, you're going to have to do your own work. And it's a very real thing. And I have a teenage son, so we're here.
Right.
And I'm not a father that's like, I'm cutting you off and you got to go figure it out. No, but you still have to go get yours. And it's those are very real conversations that I have. So for my children, that's the best parent I can be is a parent who lives in reality and not this fictitious world of, if you just go do this everything will work out.
Right. Or everything's going to work out all the time for everyone, well, and yourself included.
And that translates from viscerally as a parent, mm-hmm. right? But from a business perspective, I would assume that there's similar traits there when you're trying to manage and direct someone and teach them about the business and how mm-hmm. things can go or not go. It transcends it. So
but it's life, yourself. Not it's even life. Business.
Yeah, no, like that's what I'm saying. It transcends it. It's everything. Real, yeah. It's so everything. That's awesome.
Was there anything from your father that you're like, man, I want to teach my kids that too?
His imagination. Hmm. His imagination and his ambition.
Yeah.
Right? Because my father didn't have any leg up at all. But he literally gave us a different life.
Yeah.
Right?
He created it, right?
He absolutely.
Right.
He absolutely created it. And he saw it. He saw it before anybody else and when no one else saw it. And,
right.
you know, I remember the days of people laughing about, oh, you got these kids and these glitter outfits and, you know what I'm saying? Like, but he, like, because they're stars.
Yeah.
And his, you know what I mean? Like, this is what he's thinking and this is, you know, his outlook of this is their way out. Because for him, nobody had seen out. Everybody had seen the penitentiary, the graveyard before they reached their dreams.
Right. Well, that's awesome. Jay, thank you for coming. This was a super exciting.
Thanks, man. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming
Absolutely,
down.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
This will wrap it up. Just as I've had to learn about this, so just give me a second. Listeners, audience out there, just so you know, we're on every platform. You know, YouTube, whatever the hell it is, TikTok, all that stuff. Just download, like us, do all that stuff. Again, thank you very much
Absolutely.
For coming. I think this wraps it up, and let's have some dinner and have some fun right now. Huh?
Yeah, thanks,
Jay. Yeah.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.